KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, James Gustav Speth, a leading environmentalist, Yale University dean, and author of Red Sky at Morning, will be joining us to talk about radical proposals for planetary sustainability that he puts forth in his newest book, which is called The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. He joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. James Gustav Speth is Dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale, a graduate of Yale Law School and a Rhodes Scholar. He co-founded the Natural Resources Defense Council, chaired the President's Council on Environmental Quality under President Jimmy Carter, was president and founder of the World Resources Institute, and acted as senior advisor to President-elect Bill Clinton's transition team. He also oversaw the United Nations Development Program as its chief executive officer. He's the author of Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment, which we talked about with him, his last appearance on Forum, and a book called Global Governance and Worlds Apart and Globalization and the Environment. And his most recent book is The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. And he joins us in studio for this second Forum Hour. And Gus, welcome. Good to have you back.
Good morning, Michael. It's good to be back.
Well, this is a hopeful book, let me say that initially, and I think
Thank you. That's important.
But it's also a concession of defeat. You've been on the front lines as an environmental warrior all these years, and what you're saying is we've won some battles, we're winning some battles, but the war has been in many ways lost.
Well, I wrote The Bridge at the Edge of the World because of the paradox that you're alluding to. We have a situation where for 40 years we've been trying to get this environmental thing right. The environmental community has grown stronger. There's more money in it. There are more people. There are more organizations. And the environment has continued to go downhill to the point now that we're on the cusp of an unprecedented series of environmental losses, most notably the climate issue, but it certainly doesn't stop there by any means. The problem of toxics in the environment, the loss of our biological resources and biological diversity, the loss of our fisheries, these things are proceeding at a very rapid rate now. So there is this paradox, and so I set out in this book to understand that. How could this have happened? And how did we get ourselves in this situation, and what do we do about it now?
Well, you even point out at one point that at current rates, without any acceleration, without any growth, this would be an unfit planet to live in down the line. And you come up with that hypothesis how?
Well, look at it this way. At the current rates that we're putting greenhouse gases, climate-changing gases in the atmosphere, at the current rates that we are homogenizing and destroying and impoverishing the natural environment, our plant and animal and ecosystems that we have, at the current rates that we're spewing toxic chemicals into the environment in various ways, if we just keep doing it at the current rates, you can add these things up and you'll see that by the latter part of this century, we will effectively have ruined the planet. We will have left a miserable situation to our grandchildren. And I have some grandchildren now, and I'm deeply concerned about what we are doing to them.
Well, you talk about a duty to future generations, and I wish that somehow we could imprint that on every consumer. But
yeah, what have they done? What have they done for us? Right.
Well, there you go. That's. I mean, you're almost calling for a new value system here, a challenge to those who are consumer obsessed, really, or even just too consumer minded. And too materialistic as ways of finding happiness through consumerism. I mean, this is really a challenge to that kind of ethos, is it not?
Well, it certainly is. We are pathetic in our capitulation to consumerism and materialism, I'm afraid, myself included in many ways. we're locked into this affluenza, and it's a disease we have to fight back against. My answer to the paradox that I mentioned a second ago is that basically we're losing ground despite all the increased strength because we work and we live in an economic and political system that is enormously and I would say inherently destructive of environment. And we can talk about why that's the case, but unless we change the system, it's very much like swimming upstream in a stream that's too strong to make headway against.
Now, and what's that river you talk about as a boy, Edisto, in your boyhood?
Edisto, yes. It was a lovely black water stream that flowed through my little hometown of Orangeburg, South Carolina, in the South Carolina Lowcountry. And we always, you know, knew that if we kept swimming in it, we'd get strong enough to buck that current and make real headway against it. And then we did. And I've always thought that the environmental community would do the same, that we would get stronger and we would overcome the current and start making real progress. But the fact is that the stream gets stronger as we get stronger. There's tremendous growth of this economy and the tremendous complexity of dealing with all the problems that the system that I call the capitalism that we know, the capitalism of the street, keeps kicking up at us. And so instead of making headway against the current, we slide backwards. We're drifting away and not as fast as we would be if we didn't have all the environmental activism going on, but we're still losing it. We're losing the planet.
Well, you know, we had Bill McKibben on last week, and I pointed out to him, and I'm sure this is certainly not news to you as it wasn't to him, but we can talk till we're blue in the face about changing the current and changing the way we're navigating here in the United States. The fact of the matter is it's a global economy now. You can change consumerism here, but you've got, you know, all these Chinese who want to have SUVs eventually and, you know, who are very consumer-minded throughout the developing world and throughout the third world.
Well, that's certainly true. But, and I guess I hope this is what Bill said in response, unless we begin to set the pattern, to set the right example, to get ourselves straightened out with all of our wealth and all of our capacity, then it's very difficult to see China and India and others doing this. So my book focuses on what we in the affluent countries have to do in the near future. And basically, I think we've got to challenge this system in which we're operating much more fundamentally than our environmental community has been willing to do to date.
Talking to James Gustav Speth, he is the author of The Bridge at the End of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. He'll be talking this afternoon at the World Affairs Council of Northern California in San Francisco at noon today, and talking tomorrow at an event hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Talk about this new paradigm that you're proposing here, because it's in many ways synergistic. I mean, as I see it, you're saying environmental reality is linked to other realities, and you can't separate those other realities. And what you need to do is stop having people, again, it's a change of value. It's a sea change where instead of putting all emphasis on consumption and GDP growth, let's talk about jobs, let's talk about health care, let's talk about education, green technologies. All this makes great sense, but the will.
Well,
political will.
We have this, we are really instructed every day through advertising and in other ways to think that that our growth mania is the solution to our society's problems, and that if we can just maintain high levels of economic growth, there will be a sufficient economic opportunity for everybody, and there will be major improvements in people's lives. But all the data that I see suggests that that is a gross exaggeration. The fact is that if you look at societies in the industrial world, incomes have gone up, but their level of happiness and satisfaction with life has not. And we're putting all of their energies into these hyperventilating lifestyles, accumulating more and more stuff with more and more consumerism, and it really doesn't make us any better off at this point. If we were a poor society, you know, a long time ago, that would have been the case. But when you reach our level of affluence, we have to think about other things. And what apparently really makes people happy and satisfied with life is their interactions and their relationships with other people and their families and their communities and their friends. on the job, and that's what really counts, is people and giving, not getting. So yes, this is a fundamental
change in values. You're talking about an ideal of community too, really, aren't you?
Well, idealism, you know, what's really going to be hard is continuing the status quo, to keep doing business as usual. That's going to be really hard because it's going to cause us tremendous problems, and we're going to be spending immense amounts of resources just trying to protect. So I would say that if the ideas that I'm putting out, you know, sound like they're a little far-fetched today, wait until tomorrow, because the world is, the problems are coming at us now very hard.
Well, you're trying to save the planet, and that's.
I think we all have to be out to save the planet now. As idealistic as that sounds, that is the job.
It's admirable. It's noble. It also involves a lot of government involvement. And, you know, you say you're criticizing capitalism, but you're not a Marxist and all that. But people get very nervous when you start talking about a really strong role for government. There are many, in fact, many progressive-minded people who feel, you know, the least government is the best type of government. And you're talking about really a very prominent and very significant role for government.
Well, let's just take something very simple on that. Right now, we have one of the big problems is that the prices in our economy and a market economy is guided by prices, and the control mechanism in a market economy are prices, including wage prices, and right now those prices are environmentally dishonest because the polluters, just to take one group of people, are not paying for the damages, and so their products sell artificially cheaply in the economy, and we've got to make them pay for their environmental damages. If you have two people building the same house and one of them destroys a wetland to build that house and the other one doesn't, the house that destroys a wetland should cost a lot more because wetlands are enormously valuable. So we've got to get the internalization of these environmental costs into our prices, and that will drive up prices. But
is this what you mean when you say make the market work for the environment?
That's exactly what I mean. But to go back to your point, that will not and cannot happen except for government. Government is the way that we inject values, human values, environmental values into our economy. Because this economy is really, if it's uncorrected, it's a rapacious system that really doesn't care much about people or environment. And if we want to make it do that, it's up to us as citizens to inject these values through government into the economy. So the people who say we want to get government so small we can drown it in a bathtub, they're killing us if that philosophy prevails as it has in recent years.
Wasn't it Thoreau who said that government is best which governs least? And I mean, you do have a kind of strong American tradition for not even libertarianism, but just for getting government out of the way for a free enterprise
system.
Well,
I don't think we need unnecessary government. We don't need bloated government. But by gosh, we need government because it's our mechanism. Our democracy is what we have to do, what we have to correct the imbalances and the excesses and the ruthlessness of today's capitalism.
Well, you say corporations should be legally accountable to society, not just to themselves, not just to their shareholders. That means not only government regulation. I presume it means that corporations are no longer going to be vested with the status of being individuals as they presently are.
Well, that's an interesting story. How these amendments to our Constitution, particularly the 14th Amendment that were enacted after the Civil War to protect the rights of the freed slaves, became primarily tools to protect these artificial people called corporations is a very interesting story in our jurisprudence. But the bottom line is that we need to, in effect, recharter corporations and make them legally accountable to all the stakeholders, all the people who contribute to the wealth that they generate, including their local communities. They would then become more rooted and would basically we've lost 2 million jobs in the early years of this century with multinational corporations moving these jobs out of the United States. Destroyed communities, adversely affected a lot of individuals. There's nothing more toxic to happiness than losing a job, frankly. And So I think we need, and basically making the corporations accountable to all the people and all the communities that contribute to the wealth they generate involves changing their governance. It means bringing these people into the governance process of corporations. So the corporation is no longer simply beholden to its shareholders and is no longer mandated simply to increase shareholder wealth as they are now.
You're talking about reassertion of popular control. This is pretty radical stuff.
Isn't that odd? Isn't it odd that somebody could think that reassertion of popular control, that a vigorous, strong democracy operating to, you know, to effectuate deep human values and needs is radical stuff? It's just talk about an American tradition. That's the American tradition.
It's a comment on our American civilization, alas. But it's American-style consumer capitalism that you're really bringing into the spotlight here. As
yes, I'm no Marxist, and I don't. I think we'll. You know, I'm not, my book doesn't deal with expropriating private property or having central planning or
means of production and distribution.
Any of these dumb things. But I do think we've got to get the we're deeply subsidizing environmental destruction. We're guilty of this growth mania where we put all the sacrifice everything to growth. We need to be moving to a post-growth society. We need to be curtailing the rapacious behavior of corporations by rechartering them, and we need to address our own failings as consumers and to reassert our you know, the things that really do matter in life, things that really do count, things that, you know, you can't buy on the market with more money because that doesn't bring us real satisfaction or happiness. We need to search for fulfillment and meaning in other ways. And I think people are getting there because people are, you know, I think people are a little frustrated with this, these manufacturing lifestyles out of commercial pitches. And the other thing we do, which you alluded to earlier, is we need to deal with the vast social insecurity of our society. You know, half the people in our country, half the families make incomes of less than $45,000, and those families are sometimes quite large. And they're basically just getting by in our society. And the gap between the rich and the poor is widening, and that's affecting the power of money and large corporations in our political process. Our political process is becoming more unequal also. So these issues are all together, and I think what we need is a fusion of people who are concerned about environment, who are concerned about social justice, who are concerned about political reform, coming together and launching a real movement for change in our country.
And you have a good deal of faith, it appears, in the youth of America doing that.
Well, I see it on the campuses. I see young people getting organized. I taught some of this material and had a huge turnout for the course. That was reassuring.
This is at Yale.
At Yale. I see it in religious organizations. I see scientists speaking up and speaking out now. Average citizens, consumers. We have, if you ask people in our country, do you think the society is too materialistic? Do you think we've lost our way? Do you think we should be prioritizing other things? You get numbers like 80% say yes. And even if there is just half of that, that's still a huge huge movement, a huge opportunity for real change. So I think these forces can come together in a new social movement in our country, and that's our best hope.
But on a practical level, where should this begin? Does it have to begin, as you see it, with the individual? Does it have to begin with a social movement that simply is almost oceanic? And, you know, I mean, you're talking about social inequality, connection to nature, environmental hazards in terms of the planet's sustainability. All of these things I know you realize and envision as being interlocked and interrelated. But the fact is we've got a triage here, too, don't we?
Well, I think that one place to start is to build a real movement of concern growing out of this most threatening thing of all, and that is climate change. I mean, and I see that happening. I see people organizing to take this message that we need major federal legislation on this issue urgently, and I think we'll see a burgeoning of this of grassroots activism around the climate issue. But I have a word for the young people who might be listening to us also, Michael, and that is, it's your world. You take it back before it's too late. You're in a system where your planet, its nature, your society is being hollowed out. And if we look back at in you know, current memory, recent memory, the one time where we had something like what we need today, a movement for real change, was the Civil Rights Movement. And people took personal risk. People marched. People sat in. I grew up in a little segregated town in South Carolina, and we had disastrous incidents. People were shot and killed protesting, trying to integrate the bowling alley and the lunch counters. Well, God knows I don't want anybody to be killed, but I do think it's time to move again in the footsteps of Dr. King.
You got to find that passion, though, that was the motivator behind the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, people felt social injustice, the need to defeat Jim Crow, all of those apartheid things that existed, and feel with the same kind of fervor as you're suggesting, we're out to make it possible for future generations to live on this planet.
Well, that is exactly what we're up against at this point. We have got to bring that the spirit of the 60s back, I think. Right now, it's a cold and broken hallelujah.
Well, Obama seems to have ignited a lot of that, doesn't he?
I think Obama has brought a lot of young people into the political process, including some people I know real well, and I think it's wonderful. I think it's really wonderful, and it is a very, very good sign. But you know, unless we are building the grassroots movement bottom up, to support real change in our politics, in our economic system, in our and in our environmental management, all the proposals that are some very good proposals that are being put forward by the presidential candidates go back into this Washington disaster area and get shredded, and that's why we need a real the only solution that I know of is a real movement for change.
Does that movement mean going outside the system like you've decided to do? I mean, you've worked within the system and you said it hasn't done what it needs to do, so now I'm working outside the system, I think, aren't you?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I love what the environmental community is doing, what the environmental groups do. I think it's really necessary, and I think it's, I shudder to think what the world would be like without them. But we're still losing ground on a scale that is disturbing, and so we have to step outside this system and challenge some things that the environmental community has not been willing to challenge. You know, low prices, terrible lifestyles, this growth fetish, our affluenza, and merge our forces with other communities, communities that are deeply concerned about social injustice in our society, people who are deeply concerned about the erosion of popular control of our democracy, and get the young people and the religious communities and make some friends also and some links to the international movement for change, which in many ways is stronger outside of the U.S.
Let me bring our callers into this, and you're hearing the voice of James Gustav Speth, who actually, he's co-founder of the National Resources Defense Council. What do you think about what you're hearing here, and what would you like to say by way of response? He's been an environmentalist for over three decades. Now he's saying American-style consumer capitalism is simply unsustainable. He was also a former White House advisor, and you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is James Gustav Speth. He's the author of The Bridge at the End of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. He's also dean and professor in the practice of environmental policy at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and has been an active environmentalist and environmental advocate for over three decades, co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council, in fact, and former White House advisor to both President Carter and President Clinton. And we're going to get your responses to what he has put out here before us on this hour of Forum. He's also going to be at the Commonwealth Club in Silicon Valley Thursday, April 3rd at 6:30 p.m. And will be at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco this afternoon at noon. And let's go to your calls. Let's go first to Stephanie in Woodside. Morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm really enjoying your discussion this morning, and I think that governments do matter. I think it's all about cultural change. It's about thinking about our consumeristic society in a different way, and I'm in the reusable bag business, actually. And interestingly, if you look at Ireland, they passed a 15-cent tax on consumers, and 95% of people stopped bringing plastic bags to the stores. So governments do matter, but attitudes matter more, and we as individuals can make a difference. I'm a mom of three kids, and my business partner and I started a company, olivesmart.com, little shameless plug there, to help people think that it's fun and stylish and great to take reusable bags to the store.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, for that call. I'm going to ask Gusbeth, attitudes or government, where do you put your weight?
Well, let me mention first that I think I may have mistitled my book. I probably should have entitled it The Bridge at the End of the World, but it's actually The Bridge at the Edge of the World. It's both.
It's a little Freudian slip there, but yeah.
Yeah, well, it's exactly. It's both. It's both, Michael, I think. Change in ourselves and our values is necessary to drive governmental change, but you know, you can't have the issues successfully dealt with without major governmental action as well. And that can also lead to different behaviors on the part of people who may not have had the cultural change. So it fits together. I asked myself in this book, I said, you know, look, what can lead to a national conversion experience? What could really lead to deep cultural change fairly quickly, because that's what we need. And I asked a lot of psychologists that question, and also, you know, some psychiatrists. And one thing that kept coming back is that, one thing that produces change is a crisis, a calamity that affects people. And, you know, people, we know that from our own lives. What we have to hope for, in a way, is not a global calamity, but a series of foreshocks and warnings that create sort of a virtual calamity. And if we have that type of situation at a time where we have wise leadership in our country, and the leaders and others can help us understand what's going on in a way through telling a new story, a new narrative about our country, where we've been, where we need to go in the future, and we having this at the same time we are having a social movement, which is basically a consciousness-raising effort, and we're putting some real resources into socially related advertising, then I think these things can come together and produce a deep change in fairly short order. The alternative to that is to keep doing what we are doing, and we will have not just foreshocks and warnings, but we will have very serious calamitous situations occurring, some of them driven in environmental areas, some of them in other areas, that we don't want.
In environmental areas, we've seen some real substantial and dramatic gains. I mean, not only in things like air and water pollution, obviously in global warming, a lot of that perhaps having to do with the film that was produced by Laurie David and Incontrovertible Truth, the so-called Al Gore film. I mean, these have had real impact.
Well, I think we have turned the corner politically, so to speak, on the climate issue, in the sense that our politicians will never be able to ignore the issue like they have for decades. I mean, when I was in the Carter administration, if anybody can remember back that far, we called for major federal action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in 1980 based on the science that was available then. And actually call for action that would be appropriate today based on what we know scientifically. But it has been ignored. And I think we have turned the corner now on climate. I think thanks to Al Gore and other things, we have made a huge change. But yes, the air and water are better in our country. But what we've really done is smooth out the rough edges of the environmental deterioration that we are causing. We're still emitting climate-changing gases enormously. We consume as much oil as Japan, Germany, China, India, and Russia combined. A half the lakes and a third of the streams in the United States still don't meet the 1983 goal that was set in the 1972 Clean Water Act. A third of the people in our country live in counties which have unhealthy air. We're losing 6,000 acres a day, 6,000 acres a day of open space.
Yeah, you hit people with those kind of facts, and you know, they cringe, they recoil. It sometimes has a real visceral effect, but does it really make them act? You know, we had that whole question come up when we were talking to a couple of former environmentalists whom I'm sure you're familiar with, who have said, you know, that the Cassandra, the doomsdaying stuff, just doesn't seem to be able to make us turn the corners we need to turn.
Well, I think unless we understand the seriousness of what we're up against, we'll never do what we should be doing. I don't think we can trick people into, you know, taking the difficult steps that we need to take. We have to be honest also with ourselves, with our families, and and we have to be honest in our political system of about what we're up against and what we haven't done. And for example, I don't think the environmental community will ever really change and move in the directions that I'm advocating unless they face up to the fact that we're losing. We're losing right now. We're losing the planet. We're winning a lot of battles and losing the planet.
Let me bring more of our callers on. Steve from Berkeley, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Michael.
Sure.
Professor suggested the role of government in correcting some of the so-called externalities from environmental damage. And, of course, as an academic and economist, that's what we teach in any decent economics lecture, where the role of the benevolent planner is to correct these externalities. But when we think of government, current government, and in general, we know that, one, they're influenced by lobbies, strong political forces, and two, and maybe even more damaging, is the fact that as an educator, and I'm sure the professor must see this too, you see that the best and the brightest of our students are not attracted to government, maybe because of the salaries, maybe because of the bureaucracy. How much faith could we have that beyond simple measures like gas taxes and stuff like that, this government that is neither benevolent, neither or very high quality in terms of the people working there, is going to be able to correct these externalities?
Well, I think we need to reform our government. I don't think we'll ever achieve our environmental objectives, either the traditional ones that the environmental groups have espoused or the more far-reaching ones that I've talked about. We'll never do that with the government that we have. So I think political reform has got to be part of the environmental agenda, and it involves moving to a much stronger democracy, measures that get people back in the voting booths, measures that straighten out these the way we've done congressional districts so that we have nonpartisan congressional districting again, measures that take the corporate money out of politics. There's a certain momentum in our country for clean and fair elections, and we need to build on that. And the environmental community and everybody who's concerned about environment needs to make these political reform measures part of their agenda, too.
Let me thank Steve for the call and go right to more calls. And John, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Bioregionalism and railways are my two words as to the utility of organizing to save regions, region by region, politically, culturally, biologically, and so forth, and the utility of a new railway web to supplant the automotive transportation network in the country. I always am leery of the sort of drawdown effect of calling in words like this to a guest, so let me add a welcome to Professor Speth to the city where we're trying to prevent a new freeway being built to our particular bridge at the edge of the world. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, thank you for the call. And here's a listener, Tony, who writes, overpopulation is not discussed the way it should be. I wonder if that's because of ingrained religious and cultural reasons for having more children than can be supported. I don't discount consumerism, but what could we do to reduce population? I think, especially in terms of the global picture, it's a very important environmental question.
Well, it's important in our country also. We're the third biggest country in the world, population-wise.
And we consume. We have more population, we consume more.
And yes, and not only are we the third biggest, but we individually, we are the big consumers and the big destroyers. I think population is part of the equation, and I think it's a very significant part, and I do talk about it in the book. And we have to bring it home also. I was part of the Stop It Too movement, which had some strength in the 70s. And then we had our third child and sort of dropped out of that movement. But I think we have to bring back an educational program about the dangers of too many people.
Did you keep going after three?
No, we stopped at three. Yeah. Okay. But the problem is that even progressive folks haven't learned how to talk about this issue. And we're all, at least some of us, are very concerned about talking about it in a way that sounds like we're border vigilantes or something, and which, you know, don't want to be. But it is part of the picture, and we've got to talk about it. And it makes a big difference whether we stabilize populations globally at 8.5, 9 billion people, or we shoot beyond that into some other realm that would be even more destructive. Having said that, the economic growth, is much higher than the population growth. And for some people, it's almost too easy, I think, to say, oh, it's more people that is the problem. Even if we didn't have any population growth, and there are places that don't, Europe, the economic growth with the even existing populations, if it continues like it has in the recent past, is enormously destructive.
We go to Sean next. Morning, Sean.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question, you were talking earlier about growth, and I'm a master's student in environmental studies, and the topic of growth and sustainability comes up all the time. And I guess looking at some of the work of Prithjot Chopra and Professor Kellert from Yale and William McDonough, kind of redefining growth versus maximum growth, which most corporations tend to go for, versus optimal growth.
And smart growth,
and using kind of the systems theory that Copper puts out of following those method of designing things. So, you know, the idea of working towards being good is different from being less bad, and having that kind of a mindset. You talked about that earlier, and I'd like to hear what the professor has to say on kind of redefining our thoughts of growth.
Gus Beth.
Well, I think our society needs to grow a lot of things. It needs to
grow to be less consumer.
On the environmental front, we need whole new industries that we have to grow that are not damaging like the ones that we have now. And we also need to grow a lot of other things, like the our community solidarity, our security of our people in health and economic well-being. There's a lot of things that need to grow, but what doesn't work, in my judgment, in our society, is throwing more and more aggregate GDP growth at these problems and thinking they're going to go away. It just look at the recent past. You know, real wages haven't gone up, even though per capita GDP has gone up. Most people are not benefiting from all the economic growth that we've had, and in fact is creating a lot of social stresses, and in addition to environmental stresses, mental illnesses are up. There's a tremendous personal insecurity in our country. So I also think that part of what the caller is talking about is technological change. And I talk in the book about whether, in fact, deep, fast technological change can save us and allow us to have more and more growth with better and better technologies. And my conclusion is that in some theoretical way, that's attractive and even to some degree, large degree, possible. But the amount of technological change across such a wide spectrum of issues would have to occur so fast to offset the increasing economic growth that, you know, we haven't experienced that yet.
That's almost inconceivable, right?
I think it is. So that's part of the answer to the caller's question.
So, I'm reminded that you probably knew the late David Brower, who was a friend of ours and on the show from time to time.
Yes.
And he used to talk about the ethos of growth for its own sake as being really the most undermining problem in many respects. This idea that progress means acquisition and progress means expansion of resources when the resources are dwindling and so forth. But truth of the matter is, you've got a kind of American dream. It underlies the whole notion of the subprime crisis in many ways because people fear they're entitled to home ownership. And predatory lending notwithstanding, that's still a sense of entitlement. I deserve to have a place of my own. I deserve to have a car. I deserve to have all these goodies that, you know, I can buy with my Christmas bonus or whatever. It's really almost a mindset. It's kind of like what Blake described as mindforged manacles that people have on their heads, and I don't know how you loosen them. I mean, your book got me thinking about that.
I think a lot of people are loosening from those manacles right now. I also think that they're, you know, that half our country is nickel and dime to death, and they do deserve something better, and they're right to dream about something better and hope that they will get it. I don't think they'll get it with the system that we have right now. So we have a system right now that won't sustain people or nature, and that's a system of that type is in trouble. And so it's just I think, a matter of time. If you want to think about a utopian fantasy, think about just keep, you know, business as usual. That's the utopian fantasy. If you want to think about what's the pragmatic necessity that we have to do, think about serious change, because we do have to make these changes.
You just mentioned nature, and you talk in your book about connection to nature as a necessity, as something that we ought to, again, be rethinking as nature becomes more molested and more assaulted by technologies and advancement and progress. Nevertheless, you have some wisdom on that score? I mean, how the individual can be more connected to nature in this world that seems to be in some ways almost militating against nature?
Well, it certainly is. We think of the natural world as a place for, as if we were the master of it. And one of the most famous graduates of our school, Aldo Leopold, our school at Yale, basically created a new environmental ethic, which in effect said that a thing that protects and preserves the natural world for its own sake, quite apart from any utilitarian advantage, that is what is right. And a thing that destroys the natural world is wrong. And I think we've got to come to see ourselves as kin to wild things, as an integral part of nature,
really,
and as stewards of a system that that we're absolutely dependent upon. We need a declaration of dependence on nature.
We go to more of your calls. Phil, join us.
Thank you. Yes, I totally agree with the premise of your book, and I'm very glad to see it written, and I'm going to go out and get a copy. But I have a great concern, and that is, how do we get from where we are to an economy that is much less consumer or consumption-oriented? Certainly, when you start advancing those ideas, the powers that be, the captains of industry and finance, are going to point out what terrible consequences there will be. People by the millions thrown out of work. And I think that the strength of their argument is going to carry the day. Unless we have a financial plan, a business plan, essentially, for how to get from here to there with an acceptable level of disruption. And I'd like to hear your comments on that. I think we need to get economists involved in developing and being able to demonstrate we can get from here to there.
All right, Gus Beth.
Well, it's a very good point. If we had a very small portion of the money and the intellectual firepower that is going into figuring out how to keep propping up the current system and achieving high levels of growth. If we had just a small portion of that looking at the question that you looked at, how do we get more precisely from here to there? What is the business plan for moving from here to there? That would be a wonderful thing, and I think we could figure these problems out. My book, I hope, points the way, but if you ask me, is there a lot more to be done? Absolutely.
Let me thank the caller and go to another one of our emails from John, who says, one of the major problems of the Bush administration is the heavy hand on scientific research. Every major research institute, most universities, and dozens of Nobel laureates have joined to invite the major candidates to discuss their science policy at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia 4 days before the Pennsylvania primary, yet the candidates have not responded. As they point out on their website, it's not a science quiz, but given the major issues facing us, why don't the candidates feel it is worth their while to attend, and why is the environmental community not insisting that these issues come to the fore? Their website is sciencedebate2008.com. All of the candidates' energy policies are woefully inadequate and shallow, and they get away with it because the public doesn't pay attention to the science.
Well, I think we do need, we have had this rejection of so much science in the Bush administration, repeated panel reports from to EPA administrator on health effects of air pollutants and other things that are largely ignored. I was the head of the Council on Environmental Quality in the White House, and I was so ashamed when the executive director of the council in the Bush administration was caught changing the text of documents that were trying to describe the seriousness of the global warming problem. And he promptly left almost the next day when that was discovered and reported, and went to work for Exxon. I mean, we have had a rough time with science in this administration, and I would certainly I have not a clue really about exactly why our presidential candidates aren't rushing to talk about this issue. I think they should be.
I think it's a good point. And here's another question raised by one of our listeners named Sean. Says, I agree that losing a job is one of the biggest threats to one's personal happiness and well-being, not to mention the ripple effect job loss has on family and community. So how can we shift from a culture of feverish consumerism to something more sustainable without triggering catastrophic unemployment?
Well, we've had, catastrophic, if not overall unemployment, but tremendous job loss and substitution for less good jobs for better ones. The system that we have today is very ruthless and rough on communities and people. So I think the thing to do is to quit, focusing so much on just aggregate expansion of the economy and propping that up, which seems to be the main thing that's at work in the administration's proposals to deal with this recession. And focus a lot more on very carefully targeted programs on job retention, on stimulating employment in critical areas, on encouraging companies to stay rooted and to keep their people, major educational efforts, and also a de-emphasis on the sort of work. We are the most overworked people in the industrial world, longest working hours. More and more members of the family are going to work. We're really losing our ability to deal with the things that really matter. I think it's a third of the people in the United States say that they don't have anybody to go to talk about the most serious problems when they have them. So we need to build up this social connectedness and our communities and reinvest in the solidarity of our people.
You've read Bob Putnam's work, I take it.
Yes, that was what I was referring to.
Yeah, about social capital and all.
Exactly.
Let me get more of our calls on. Jeff, morning.
Good morning. Michael, you said that you were concerned that there's a considerable selfishness in which people tend to think, I want a home, I want a car. And they're not thinking about the consequences of those choices.
Actually, forgive me, I use the word entitlement. I don't think I ever use the word
entitlement.
Yeah.
But my point is that our culture promulgates that viewpoint. We tend to think of, whenever we think of we think of homogeneity. We are taught that we're supposed to be individuals and that, in fact, it is our responsibility to take care of ourselves and never become dependent on anyone else. So if we have that attitude and it's ingrained throughout our culture, how do we think of ourselves as we and think of others when every day we're taught to think of ourselves as independent and alone?
Well, it's a good point. Certainly, American culture has strong roots in terms of individualism, and me, me, me is the narcissistic cry that Christopher Lash wrote about in the culture of the 60s.
And it's killing us now. It really is. I mean, it's eroding our own sense of well-being. We need a new story, and I'm not the best person to tell this story, but we need a story of a people who struggled to make a strong start, to overcome scarcity, to overcome the ravages of nature on people, and succeeded beyond their wildest dreams and created this phenomenal capacity to generate more and more stuff and more wealth and more prosperity. But along the way, we ignored the signs that were trying to urge us to go back and reclaim ourselves, reclaim our communities, reclaim nature before we hollow it out. And that's a story that we need to talk to the American people about.
On that note of our need for a new story, we're going to conclude this hour, but thank you, Gus Beth. Good to have had you back. And by the way, he'll be appearing with the Commonwealth Club at Kellogg Auditorium, Silicon Valley Bank. That's April 3rd and 6:30 p.m. on Thursday. And again, this afternoon at the World Affairs Council here in San Francisco. And the book is Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism and the Environment and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. We're with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back on tomorrow. We're going to talk about the candidacy of Barack Obama in our opening hour tomorrow, and we'll follow that up with an hour with Lewis Lapham, who is for 30 years or so editor of Harper's Magazine. We'll talk about money with him, among other things. And I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and producer, Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Tina Lauerberg, Nick Vadinsky, and Inga Schrabsdorf. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.